Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The fact is that a week before I was dropped from the England team for the first time in 11 years, I had given my account of what I felt was discrimination towards me, what I felt was a bullying culture. So, whichever way you look at it, being part of that culture review has potentially cost me my England career.
Hello and welcome to The Book Club with me, Kate Mason.
And me, Jim Campbell.
For this week's Book Club, we start in a fairly conventional place. Some kids are just really good at football. Wherever they go, they'll find other kids to play with. They're honing their skills so that by the time they're being scouted, it's so instinctual that people say they were born to play the game. Parents watching on predict great things, glory, top clubs, if they can just show the right people what they've got. And Iluko is one of those kids. But unfortunately for her, just letting her football do the talking wasn't to turn out to be the only option.
I categorically refused to write any statement because I'd already suggested that it's not for me to come up with that determination that the FA are institutionally racist. I've never said that publicly, and I'd never say that. My comments have always been based on what I felt were racist comments to both myself and Juju Spence.
This week for Book Club, we're reading They Don't Teach This by Eniola Eluko.
Still Eluko. Still Eluko. Going all the way. What a chance. What a goal by Eluko. She's beaten the entire Dutch defence and equalised with an outstanding solo effort. Eniola Eluko does it all herself. What a goal.
Eniola Eluko's professional achievements make for extraordinary reading. She has 102 England caps, has won multiple titles playing at the highest level in England, Italy and the United States, and is an Olympian, having represented Team GB at London 2012. She was also the first female pundit on Match of the Day, and for good measure is a qualified solicitor too. For many people outside of football, she is known for taking on the FA after they failed to look into her concerns about racial discrimination and bullying within the England women's setup. And she covers that story with candour here, but They Don't Teach This is really the story of how an extraordinary woman pushed herself and her talents to their very limits and about what she learned on the way. And I'm so happy to say, guys, that we have Eni Eluko here in the Football Ramble studio to tell us all about that. Eni, thank you so much for joining.
Guys. Thank you so much for an amazing introduction.
It's just so great that you've been able to come in and talk about They Don't Teach This. And one thing that we really enjoyed, I think, reading the book is how listening to the story of a female player in your era, if you like, is so much more akin to something from the men's game in like the 60s, where you can really relate to the player, like
the kind of money they're on, the kind of lifestyle they're leading.
Right.
And it's so interesting to hear that side of football playing out.
Yeah, no, well, thanks. First of all, thanks for reading the book. I still always get so sort of happy when I see peers, peers that I respect, reading my book. But you're right. I think, I look back and I think, wow, we really played for the love of the game. You know, and it's the real romantic side of it was what it was for such a long time, probably up until 2012, where the Olympics kind of was a bit of a game changer for women's football and the money and the sponsorship started coming in. But prior to that, it was like, I was just an ordinary person trying to kind of balance becoming a lawyer and having a good plan B and, playing football. When I was a bit younger at Birmingham, we used to pay subs, we'd pay £5 for our kit and we were happy to do so because it was like, we just loved football. And I think now it's pretty topical actually, because I think there's been a lot of conversation in football around, what the lower tier of football looks like and how important it is for football. And it reminds me of women's football. It reminds me of that. Like we really used to do it just for the love of it. And ultimately, I think that's what keeps us going. That's what keeps it very honest.
Yeah.
It sounds like from the book, there are some great passages early on when you talk about playing on the field near where you lived with your brother and just the kids that lived around there. And, you talk of sort of dreaming about playing at Wembley and I used to kick a ball around with my brother in the garden and we'd dream about playing at Wembley. But at the same time, did you have to sort of edit that dream so that when you played at Wembley, women's football took off as well? And so you had to, it's almost like there's more had to happen in your dream than in mine. But it actually did take place in that way. Because it sounds like from the book, it took a while to even find a women's team, to even find the women's game, let alone just kicking the ball around with your mates outside.
You're absolutely right. I think, so I started playing football at 5 years old. In the local estate in Birmingham, and it was all boys. And I was very easily accepted within the boys group, but I became known as sort of the only girl in the boys team. And I was quite happy with that. But then it started, then it kind of became a thing where it was like, well, I can't be the only girl, surely.
I can't be the first person to have thought of this.
I'm not an alien. It's like come from another planet. So then you're right. It took until 12 years old for me to actually see other girls that played football. And I think in relation to the dreaming stuff, I couldn't really dream about Wembley because it just wasn't even any close to being attainable because it wasn't on TV. There was nothing close to it aside from watching the Williams sisters play at Wimbledon, and it was a completely different sport.
Yeah.
So between the ages of 10 and 12, I actually played tennis because I was like, actually that's probably more of an attainable thing to do. Two strong black women, and it became something I wanted to do, but then I quickly realised I wasn't as good at tennis as I was at football. So I wasn't really able to dream like my brother. So the road was really windy in a way. There wasn't sort of a linear. I probably realised I could become a professional footballer when the year before I got offered a contract. It wasn't something I grew up thinking I could do at all, actually.
Yeah.
Did that bother you? So Sonny, obviously he's playing for Reading doing really well in the championship, top of the table, I think. Did that, when you became aware of that, did that bother you? Because you obviously playing together, he's younger than you, right?
He's 2 years younger.
Yeah. So you're like the older one, you're the senior partner here, but he could go on and have something that...
Yeah, not really. I mean, my mother's very wise and sort of quite philosophical. And she never really made me feel as if I was disadvantaged for being a girl. Mm. It was more, you have a different path and you have, your gift will be used in different ways to your brother. So I always saw it like that. And it was, we enjoyed this sport together. We were big Man United fans growing up before Eric Cantona broke my heart and left. So we shared the passion of football. And I always saw my path that was going to be different to his. Mm. It was never a sort of a resentment thing or, he always says to me now, you have so much more options than I do coming out of the men's game. Obviously, financially, you know, it's completely different. But in terms of career security moving forward, he always says to me, actually, you have more going for you. Because you've gone to, you know, you've become a lawyer, you've done a master's, you've done all of these things. And whereas he kind of looks at it and says, okay, I'm secure for the rest of my life, but I still want to I still want to do something with my life, you know. So it's quite an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, I suppose that's part, but I guess that is because you have done something quite special, though many women's players had to do that because, you know, they knew they're not going to be set up for life. And we'll definitely talk more about that as we go. But I want to hear a bit more about, so you were a good player, you found a team to play with, and then you were called up to the England squad. Yes. And unfortunately, you were going to stand out on the first day you turned up for that. Can you tell us a bit about that? That really, like,
I haven't lived down
me.
The story. I got called up for England at 14. I was playing for Birmingham at the time. And it was a massive deal. Like, it was a huge deal for me and my family. And the letter came through. My mom laminated the letter immediately. This is where laminating was like the thing to
pretty
do.
Pretty big, yeah. So it didn't get damaged, right?
It didn't get damaged. So she kind of laminated it. And it was this big thing in the house. And anyway, it was at the first camp, I believe, was at Loughborough. Yeah, it was Loughborough. And my mom was like, well, you know, there was sort of no direction as to what to wear. So my mom was like, well, no, you've got to wear, you've got to look smart. You know, almost as if like it was my first day of school. So I turned up to the England camp, like in like a skirt suit and shoes. And it was like, oh God, I realized it wasn't that, it was, you know, everybody else was in England tracksuits or tracksuits of some sort.
But beforehand, and, you must have, did you think?
No, I didn't. No, I generally didn't know. I just thought, I it was kind of seen as this big thing.
Smart, yeah.
In my house, it was like, no, you got to turn up. You can't turn up in a tracksuit.
Yeah, like you're getting an MBE or something.
Yeah, like that. It was like that. And we just didn't have a clue. So I turned up and I think, you know, I've never lived it down. It's quite a funny story, but I quickly rushed and got a tracksuit on when I got there. But
so you took a spare tracksuit just in case?
No. So I had to ask for one.
Oh, God.
When I got there, because it was like, well, you know. So for most of the sort of meetings and stuff, I had, I had my introductory meetings, I had my suit on, and it was just really embarrassing because it was like, oh, God, you know, the kid that didn't quite get the memo. But actually, I think looking back, it really reinforced how much it meant, like how important it was for me and my family.
Yeah, and before you were able to go, that was another crucial moment in the book that I thought was told really nicely about your passports.
Yes. So at the time, I didn't have like my British passport. So we'd been in England for a long time, and so we were eligible but we just never got round to actually getting one. Mm. And you know, at this point, my mom, you know, single parent, grafting, had just started a new business. So the getting sort of traveling wasn't high on the list of priorities. So she just didn't think, you know, didn't necessarily think about it. And then it was like, oh, I need one. I needed a British passport. And it was this kind of, it was almost like a sort of a challenge to who I was, because all of a sudden it was like, why don't I just have a British passport? Like, and then I sort of, my Nigerian-ness hit me, and, you know, being different, a different kind of England player kind of hit me.
Yes.
I was so desperate to kind of have this passport and, you know, be just sort of accepted in the group, that it kind of embarrassed me. But actually, it was just reality of who I was. You know, I was a sort of, you know, second generation Nigerian immigrant who had, you know, grown up in England, but I'd never had to think about it before then.
Yeah, the phrase you use in the book is hyphenated, isn't it? Which is a really nice way of looking at and giving both of those kind of backgrounds and identity sort of equal weight.
Yes.
So, I mean, one of the things I found really eye-opening in the book was how much pride you talk about in being an Olympian, not just a just a footballer or an Olympic footballer, but actually an Olympian as well, which I think is with. It's something that, as a football obsessive, it's sort of easy to forget that that's a separate thing when you think about Team GB at the Olympics. And that seemed to be something that really kind of brought the women's game forward in a huge, huge way. So, I mean, that must have, been unreal, right? Just to be a part of that.
It was unreal. And to be honest, I think football's a little bit snobby in that sense.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's... And we had this kind of snobbery where we thought, you know, football was going to be the be-all and end-all of the Olympics. And it just wasn't. Like, we were just, like, we were, like, not important in comparison to all the other incredible athletes that were, like, getting up at 6 a.m. swimming and running and doing all the other stuff. And the experience allowed us to understand that, you know. So I made a point of kind of watching the boxing and watching the archery and all these other sports that I'd never been exposed to. And it really humbled us as footballers because it was like, we don't do anything near what these people do. Like, we should never complain again, you know? So that whole experience, it just made me so proud to kind of be an athlete amongst a sort of family of athletes. I remember walking, you know, we stayed in the Olympic Village for a week. And it was like this sort of athlete utopia. It was like, it was amazing. I remember walking into the lift and Mo Farah was there and I was kind of like, oh my God, it's Mo Farah. He had no idea who I was. And it's just an amazing experience. And as you said, it really opened the world up to women's football because we opened up the Olympics. And I think it was like, oh, women are really good at football. Yeah. And then everyone sort of jumped on the bandwagon and followed us. And we, you know, we played at Wembley, 70,000 people. It was just incredible. It was just, you know, a highlight of my life, I think.
I'm so excited to hear you talk about it because it was so, London 2012 was like, I don't know, just for me in deciding to become a sports broadcaster, it was like a massive moment
then.
And watching women play football in at Wembley and just seeing all those people watching it, it just like I just cried. I just thought it was
amazing.
So exciting.
It was amazing. It was really a game changer. Because we'd had a Euros in 2005, but it didn't really have the same kind of global impact that the Olympics did for women's football. And lo and behold, off the back of that, the WSL started, clubs started giving their contracts to players, better facilities, better resources, because I think it just lifted the respect of the game and the investment in the game. And here we are now in 2020, where it's kind of the best league in the world. So I'm just super grateful to have been sort of right place, right time, home Olympics and playing.
Because being a footballing Olympian is pretty special as well, as a British person, because
it doesn't really happen.
It doesn't really happen.
I mean, I think obviously we'll have a team in the 2020 Olympics, but that's taken a lot of political wranglings, I think.
I mean, the most kind of bizarre time, I think, feels like when you were 18 and you were trying to pass your exams to get into university. You, if I remember right, you had an exam kind of moved somewhere so that you could then leave for the Euros.
Yeah, so...
Did you... Looking back on that now, Annie, because in the book it feels like, oh, this is all just quite chaotic and wild, and oh, look, I'm doing an exam, but I'm also playing international football.
I had to have a lie down in reading about that.
Yeah, it's
amazing that you managed that.
It's bonkers. I mean, I look back now, I'm like, oh my God, why did I do that? But I think at the time, I was just in this mindset all the time of like, how can I play football? Like, I just need to be able to play football. So whatever I can do to fit around that. Mm. I mean, there was no real compromise on my education. You know, my mom was quite strong on that. And I, you know, I'm the kind of person, I always want to do well in whatever I do. So I wanted to do well in my GCSEs and my A-levels. So, but the timing just clashed. So when it came to, we played at the Etihad Stadium, well, the now Etihad Stadium, I can't remember what it was called then. And, I managed to arrange for my college to let me do the exam in some random place in Bolton. I can't remember. It was random.
That can't help you. Build
all the logistics as well.
Yeah.
Like,
and shout out to Hope Powell as well, who let me do it. Because, I mean, she could have easily said, no, that's not going to work. Like, I need you prepared and head on the game. But she allowed me to do it. She believed in education. And yeah, so I did the exam in the morning, got this really fancy Mercedes chauffeur to the game, and yeah, got ready for the game, was on the bench, came on. Yeah, and got a D in the exam. So I wouldn't advise it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't advise that kind of prep to anyone.
I guess like it is easy to look back on that and go, that's so much to take on. But that's you know, with me having read the book and you having obviously lived your life, like we know we have the benefit of hindsight. But I guess at the time, like, it would have been the same for all female footballers. You didn't really know where the game was going.
No, we didn't.
So you had to take that chance. Yeah. Is that or defer for a year?
Yeah, like, exactly. And there was a lot of players that were working, you know, had mortgages. It's a little bit like how rugby was back in the day, you know, for the men's sides.
It the was gentlemen like, amateurs, though.
Yeah, that it was like
we must not take money.
Right, we were amateurs. We were, and we were sort of trying to sort of play for our country whilst trying to forge, you know, careers like any other, you know, young people. So it was tough, but I think it's made us stronger, you know, now, because now we look at the game and we go, you know, certainly for someone like me who's still working in the game, and I'm able to sort of have relationships with players where I can sort of guide them and help them. It's being able to say, look, you know, football is a priority, but invest in yourself too. Invest in your plan B. Invest in your education. You know, I'm really pleased to have just launched a program at Aston Villa called Students of the Game, and I wanted it to be that the club were investing in, you know, the education of players, so that whatever happens in their life, whether they get injured a lot, you know, God forbid a long-term injury, or they get released, they don't feel like their life is over. Mm. They've got some other aspect of their life that they can put energy into. I think it's super important.
Well, it's really been a big problem and something that's been discussed. I mean, recently, a kid killed himself off the back of
17. I mean, whenever I read his age, I just think, God, like it just makes my heart sink.
Mm.
But that's what I'm talking about. This kind of football is everything. It defines me. It's everything. It's so dangerous because actually for every Raheem Sterling, there's about 20 kids that don't make it.
And you can't expect these kids to have the level of emotional maturity that is needed at that age to handle such a big rejection, isn't it? If you are at a huge club and it doesn't work out, it's gonna just punch this hole in your life. And it's, as you say, it's so important that there's a net there, that there's something ready
to... It's that aftercare bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's also, and it's also just giving people other avenues. Investing in people. You know, I think players have become commodities and assets, but it's people. You know, if I say to you, you know, we want to give you everything to be a top footballer, but we also want to give you everything to, you know, make sure that you're studying and in a course you want to study in, it's up to you what you do with it. But I'm investing in you as a person outside of you as a footballer. It has nothing to do with the club, you know, in terms of... So it's, I think more clubs should do it, because, you know, you can't be defined, and forget football, anybody, you know, whatever we do in life, we our work, you know, some of us are lucky to sort of our passion becomes our work, which is really great. But for those of us that have, you know, jobs, you can't let it sort of take over your life. And, you know, you've got to sort of have another outlet. I think it's really healthy.
It sounds as though it did for you. Some of the passages where you, for example, didn't win the FA Cup time with Chelsea.
Yeah.
You know, spoiler alert, she does in the end, guys, which is great. And I think that's credit to the kind of the process of writing the story with with Josie LeBlond, who you wrote it alongside. You clearly are someone who feels things very, very deeply in terms of defeat like that and the way that that's written. I mean, I loved the fact that you could get a real hold on what it meant to you. It was a real kind of privilege to be inside your mind in that moment. But wow, how did you deal with that?
Yeah, no, I think, so everything I've just said, I think is me sort of 5 years on from that victory. and 6 years on from the biggest failure of my life. And so I've learned a lot of, I've learned that actually you can't just sort of let football dictate everything. And, you know, so the book starts off talking about that failure where, you know, we lost on the last day of the season and we lost the league on the last day of the season. It was this big public embarrassment. I felt like I'd let loads of people down, wanted to quit football. It was like, I'm done. And it was this kind of like, you know, just shattering of like, I just felt completely worthless. And I was working at the time at a law firm part time. And I remember writing in and saying, I can't come to work. And I got an email, and this was a massive reality check for me. And I got an email back from my boss at the time. And he said, Annie, I understand, you know, you've lost a football game, but there's a staff member who lost his wife recently. Like, and he still came into work. And I was like, oh.
Oh, God.
And do you know what I mean? And it's sort of, it was this kind of like, football was, I just couldn't, it was like, it was everything. And there was no perspective. And I think failure can be that for a lot of people. Like if it, you know, it's really important that I think I learned that failure can be a springboard to success, and you can't let it kind of defeat you in the way I let it defeat me. I was like, I want to quit football. I can't go into work. Obviously you can be disappointed and you can process it, but it can't be a thing where it just kind of overtakes your life. So, you know, and that was 2014, 2015, we won. So, and I genuinely think the reason we won is because everybody in that team was able to process that defeat, and it give us this fire to kind of go that one step further. And I don't think Chelsea have looked back since. You know, since 2015, it's just been win after win after win. It's like it broke something.
Yeah.
So I'm super proud of that. Super proud of not just, you know, the win, but the lesson about, you know, failure and success, and using failure to kind of, you know, shape you, make you better.
It sounds like a very intense way to live your life if you're like living at that level of competition.
Too much.
You know,
it's too much.
And that
yeah.
may, that this kind of leads me to something I've been wondering about your retirement, which is fairly recent. So you retired with Juventus having won a treble and finished as their top scorer. So I think we can assume you've probably got something left in the tank if you did want to carry on.
Yeah.
But did you deliberately choose to go out on a high?
Yes.
So as to like go, you know what, I'm done with how stressful this is.
Right.
And
right. You've summed it up. That's exactly what I was thinking. I think that's just how my brain kind of works. And I also didn't really want to kind of, there's a combination of factors. So there's that, what you've just said about sort of always wanting to leave at the top of the mountain, which is, there's something kind of really empowering about that. I was also missing home. You know, living in Turin, Juventus is everything. And I'm a person that actually likes to have things outside of football, as I've mentioned. So that was quite all consuming living in Turin for that amount of time. And then there was like, you know, the opportunities here. It was like, okay, do I get 1 year contract at maybe a lesser club? Or do I try and now focus on the next 5 years of my life, start another career? There was that. So I wanted to invest in my future and obviously take on this sporting director job. But it was a combination of all those things. But I quite like the fact I finished at the top of the mountain in that way. Sort of, you know, put your flag in and off you go.
Sail off into the sunset.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break just now and come and hear about what it takes to get to that sunset, I guess.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Wrestle Me is a show where two men watch every WrestleMania from 1 to 37, unpicking the multicoloured threads that tie it all together.
I think it's slightly something to do with the fact that Americans don't really like cell phones, do they? Right. I think they've all got basic ones, basically.
That's a big shout.
It is a big shout, but I mean, there is something funny about it, like text messaging never took off in the States.
What? Come on now.
Never been big.
Whether you're a lapsed fan or someone who doesn't give a flying laureate about it, there's something for everyone.
If you can get a crowd to boo you for kicking a fabulous ladder.
Fabulous ladder.
And the crowd are booing.
Yeah. Off that lovely ladder we've just learned about.
It's a beautiful polysexual ladder.
It's a beautiful homebase shabby chic creation.
If you climb up to it, ecstasy can be found at the top.
Listen via Spotify, Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pods.
Wrestle Me is a Staccano production.
All right, guys, welcome back to the book club. Today with Eni Aluko, in with Jim and me to talk about her book, They Don't Teach This, all about her life as a professional footballer and a tiny bit heading off into the sunset, as we just mentioned. Before the sunset arrived, I don't think it's the sunset, is it, Eni? You're, what, 33?
Yeah, I mean, people have told me that I retired very early. But I think people forget I started very early.
Yeah, and you've achieved, as
so
we've talked about.
In relative terms, it's been a long, long, long journey.
You've achieved an enormous amount. And you've also, as we mentioned in part one, we've talked about all sorts of different areas of not just the sport, but also law that you got involved in, working part-time in a law firm, completing all those exams while playing for England, playing for Team GB. Mm. I mean, you know, would you say one of the most difficult things you had to contend with was this period of time where you ended up talking to having to deal with questions within the England women's setup about how the FA was running the women's game. I guess the summary of it is that in 2014, Mark Sampson became the boss of the England women's team.
Yeah.
And you were, at that stage, building a career at Chelsea. You'd go on to become the side's all-time top scorer. You were named the Women's Player of the Year in the 2015 double-winning season.
Yes.
Not bad.
Yes.
And anyway, Mark Sampson came in. You know, you seemed to be in the form of your life for your country too. You were top scorer in World Cup qualifying for the 2015 tournament. You started to feel as though he didn't maybe value you as a player as much as you were used to, I guess, with Hope Powell. And then as time went on, you started to hear strange comments about you and another player, and you started to feel as though there was something bigger going on. Is that a good summary of it?
No, that's a perfect summary. I think that, you know, as you said, at that point I was 11 years in. So I was a senior player and somebody that, you know, for me felt like I was very important to the journey of where the women's team had gone. I sort of was always somebody that used my voice to try and improve standards for the women's game, not just for myself, but for the whole team and for the whole game. It's a real passion of mine is the women's game. So I felt that the level of respect based on that and in comparison to other people who probably didn't have as much experience was slightly odd. But often when a new manager comes in, there is a sort of, you know, it's like dating. You're sort of trying to suss each other out. So I would just, you do what footballers do and you just sort of say, okay, well, I'll just show you on the pitch, which I felt like I was doing. As you said, I was having a very, very good season with Chelsea. And I almost felt like the more successful I was becoming, the worse the treatment got. And one thing I hope has come across in the book as well is that, you know, whether it's racism, whether it's bullying, whether it's sexism, often these behaviours are silent. They're not always something that's said. Mm. It's a feeling. It's a set of behaviours by a group of people towards you that makes you feel incredibly isolated. And as I said, after 11 years, I'm not supposed to feel isolated. That's my home, right? I'm an England player. I've earned it. I've earned the right. So it was just really, really horrible because I felt so isolated. I felt so paranoid. I felt like people were talking about me all the time. But it was coming from the coach. So, of course, people were talking about me. He was giving them license to. And later actually admitted that to me. So it was a really, really difficult time in my life because it really just made me question, like, you know, leadership and how the culture of the England team and where it was kind of leading to. Really, really difficult time. Probably the hardest time of my life, actually.
It's quite a tough read at points, reading about that, purely because, as you said, there's a lot of insidious stuff happening where the treatment of you can be read in a lot of different ways, which is probably by design, because, you know, it reads very much as if, and the situation clearly seems you've been a victim of racism and sexism and all kinds of different things. But I almost get the impression that on the surface, it was like you were being victimized for being an introvert. Like, because, you know, you holiday alone sometimes and sometimes you keep yourself to yourself and some people just do, you know, some people are just introverted and then like, oh, you don't join in is actually this horrible Trojan horse for a lot of other things that were under the surface. And it feels like, feels like the FA had control of the narrative for a long, long time and tried to sort of paint you as a difficult person.
Yeah. Well, the FA stuff actually didn't come in until much later. So Mark Sampson came in 2014. It didn't. This sort of episode didn't go public until 2017, and that's when the FA stuff really started to double down because effectively they were protecting him. So there was a 2-year period really where this stuff was going on for quite a long time, and as you said, because I felt so isolated, I was kind of isolating myself.
Yeah.
And actually, I do like to kind of go for walks on my own and you know, I have an independent mind. And I think in a lot of cultures, whether it's corporate cultures, whether it's team sport cultures, there's this kind of risk of groupthink where everybody has to think the same, talk the same, look the same, be the same. It's super dangerous because actually, what about individuality? We're all different. So you shouldn't feel demonized for having a different view. And as I said, I was always somebody who used my voice. Nobody cared about that before Mark Sampson arrived. When he arrived and created a culture where that was wrong, I was then the black sheep, for want of a better term. So it was like I was balancing, okay, I'm here to play football and I just want to get in and get out. And this is part of a culture I just feel really, really strange in and don't feel like my voice wants to be heard. So gradually my voice just became, I just wasn't speaking. I just didn't speak to anyone. Mm. And I suppose it was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm. Yeah. Because you were then... It was then pointed out that you weren't joining in if you felt things weren't going your way. And, your reaction to being badly treated was then used as another stick to beat you with. It sounds like. So one of the things I found really interesting was that it seemed like some of your teammates were susceptible to this idea as well. And there's a point where the England team run over to celebrate with the manager when this stuff had started to come out. So I'm interested, since the book has come out and you've been able to, you know, have your right of reply and get your side of the story over, has that changed sort of some of the perceptions of people that you knew at the time? And has that been like, have you managed to take control of the narrative again a bit? Have people reacted to you differently now that they actually know what really happened?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, so the FA side of it was, so once, so let's rewind a little bit. So I was asked, ironically, to be part of a culture review by the FA team. And their view was, you've been in the team a long time, give us your views on the culture confidentially. And I actually saw it as an opportunity to just be really honest and say, look, guys, like, I'm struggling. And a few other people who look like me are too.
So you didn't think that that was all part of a sort of a setup? That felt to me as though that was something...
It felt like, well, not at the time, no. Yeah. Maybe naively, I just thought, oh, okay. And I'd always got on with the FA. You know, I did my work placement at the FA. Like, so it wasn't odd for them to ask me to do something. I used to pretty much be the media spokesperson for the team. You know,
because speak so well, yeah.
It wasn't odd. So I was like, okay, cool, like, I'm going to be honest. If it's a safe space and if we're confidential, I'm going to tell them that, like, this has been a struggle. Mm. You know, forget what's going on the pitch and me being able to score goals. Like, I'm struggling. And I did that. And, you know, within 10 days, I was dropped from the team. And then I sort of started to figure out what was going on, or what I perceived what was going on. And, then next minute it was in the papers. So once it got into the papers, it was then David v. Goliath, media machine, smear campaign, she's bitter, she's angry, she was a bully anyway, all of this really nasty, sinister stuff that I then had to kind of put my right of reply. And I think when I did that with the BBC and with The Guardian, it was like, oh, that makes sense.
Mm.
And so I think at that time, hopefully it kind of balanced out what was really horrible, stuff being said about me that just wasn't true. And then, I had the opportunity to kind of, in the book, really give people an idea of, this wasn't something that just happened in 2017. This is like, you know, this is what perceived bullying or racism looks like. Like, it's a series of events.
Mm.
Yes.
You know, because I
all
think
of which are deniable
was,
in
I think
some cases.
That was the perception that I really bothered me, that it was this like, oh, she got dropped and used the race card. It's like, no, like, actually, I complained about this for a long time. So, and look, there'll always be people who want to think what they want to think. And there'll always be people who have a sort of defensive view. I think from the player's point of view, going back to the cultural piece, it was such a strong culture of groupthink, which had its benefits. You know, we ended up getting to the, you know, get a bronze medal in the World Cup. It has its benefits on the pitch, but off the field, if you don't think like everybody else, you're isolated, you're ostracized. So it wasn't a surprise to me that most of the players who benefited from that culture weren't going to back me.
You don't want to rock the boat because
it's human nature, isn't it?
And it's difficult out there. It was obviously a difficult time for you. And you can see why people who didn't feel as though they had skin in the game because they were actually benefiting wouldn't want to get involved. And I think
I think
that's not to justify them.
You're right. I think there isn't really. I think it's just an explanation of how kind of human beings react. It's sure. Like, okay, how's this going to affect me? I can't rock the boat. Women's football, you know, was still at a point where like the FA were paying salaries. So it's like, I'm not going to give up my life for you any. Like, and I get that. I think what disappointed me more is that people doubled down and started to say, well, I never saw any racism, and sort of tried to paint me out to be a liar. So you cannot say anything, and then you can say something that's actually very damaging. That was the part where I was like, that's not right. But some, you know, some players since then have privately messaged me and sort of apologized and said, look, I've realized that actually what happened to you was really, 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 really bad, and I wouldn't want it to happen to anyone else. And I, you know, and I talk about forgiveness in the book. You know, I really had to get to a point where I was like, I let it go. And you know, I lost my England career because of this, so I had to let it go. It was eating away at me. I was angry. I was I've sort of let it go and risen above, and I see it kind of now as that door closed and so many other doors opened. Maybe I wouldn't have been able to go to Juventus. Maybe I wouldn't have sort of done lots of the punditry stuff I've been able to do. Like, there's so much I've done since then that I'm very grateful for. Yeah. And I think if we look at some real bad, difficult moments in our life like that, then we're able to sort of put them in a box and, you know, learn from it.
Mm. That's a common trope, though. I mean, when we spoke to Paul Canneville, Chelsea's first black player for a book club a little while ago, he said that he'd had people come up to him in the context of racism. He'd had people come up to him who had been abusing him on the terraces and calling him like unspeakable, disgusting things, had subsequently come up to him maybe like 10 years later and said, oh, yes, you know, I want to apologise, which is, I guess, good that someone's gone on a journey like that. But is it not?
I think we're products. I think without even knowing it, people are products of their environment. And
you want to fit in.
You want to fit in. So you do things that, like, you know, there's all sorts of books on this, like, you know, people talk about
crowd think, groupthink.
You know, there's, you know, without sort of making any sinister, really sinister comparisons, but like, you know, I've read books on sort of Nazi soldiers who did really awful things but actually didn't want to do it. So it's like, it's that kind of, and back in Paul Canneville's time, it was okay to shout those kind of things. It was cultural. But You know, so people come to the realization in their senses. A lot of the messages I received from players was this year when George Floyd stuff happened. And they're like, oh my God, like, when I had the time to do something, I didn't.
Yeah. Or didn't even notice it, to go by their own accounts of it.
People come to a realization later, and it's okay, because it's like, I'd rather you come to it than just pretend like everything was fine. But I think a lot of people just are they're products of really quite damaging cultures.
It's tough being that canary in the coal mine, though, isn't it? Like, you having to go in and suffer that.
It is tough. But like I said, you know, I don't see myself as a victim. I see myself as somebody that, okay, that was meant to happen to me. My career, England career, was meant to end in that way. And as a result, there's many things that I've done that other players didn't have the benefit to do. And I kind of look at it like that, like, okay, that door closed and lots of other amazing doors opened. It wasn't great, it wasn't fun, but it's a bit like a bad relationship and a relationship that ended, and you just think, thank God I'm not with him anymore, or her. You know, it's a bit like, you kind of look back and you're like, okay, well, it's all right.
What you came on to do afterwards, it'd be nice to talk about a little bit as well. Being the first female pundit on Match of the Day in 2014.
Yeah.
That's really massive, because it's one of those examples of a tide turning like instantly. The day before, that had never happened and was never going to happen. And then that day, it opens the door for all of the success that lots of people, you know, including plenty I could think of as people I really admire, and of course Alex Scott, who's doing so well, you know, in mainstream television as well, if you like, these days. But how did that come about? Because so you were still very much, you know, a full-time athlete at that stage, weren't you?
Yeah, so I think just a build up of things, really. So I'd sort of done a lot of sort of small interviews for the England team. I was always kind of the one that was sort of pushed forward to do interviews, and I was happy to do so. And had built a kind of rapport with lots of different journalists and reporters who just kind of enjoyed the fact I was so open. I got an agent around the same time, and I wanted to kind of just try and develop my media career a little bit. So I did lots of like kids TV stuff and like lots of little like radio stuff, and which gave me confidence that I could do it. And then after about 2 years, it came the opportunity to do Match of the Day. And I think this is when the media was starting to kind of try and see, okay, let's try and include women in this, you know, let's see. And I was sort of a beneficiary of that, maybe an experiment at the time. So I did feel the weight of responsibility, because I knew that if I don't do well, I'll just be cast off as, oh, she's a woman, she doesn't know what she's talking about. So I saw it as an opportunity and not a barrier.
It's really tough though, because a lot of being good at broadcasting, as you know yourself now that you've done a hell of a lot, is not just the preparation, which you obviously, and you can hear in the book, if you want to learn how to be a pundit, get this book, guys. It's really interesting about how any prepared and very different to many people, as you also mentioned, who turn up and are like, what the bloody games, what are we doing here? You know, you obviously prepared a lot, but a lot of the way of being good at broadcasting, I think, it comes with practice. So there's a massive pressure on you to turn up.
It was huge pressure, but I think I just said to myself, and maybe this is part of my legal training as well, like as a lawyer you prepare a case, and you know there's a sort of end date where you go into court and you sort of present that case and you win or you lose. It was a little bit like that, in the sense that I was like, right, if I know my stuff and I know, you know, I know sort of my topics and what I'm talking about, then it's just about delivery. And I had really good advice at the time from my agent, who said, just pretend it's like mates, in, you know, you're just chatting like with your mates in a living room. And so when I got on the show, it was John Motson and Kevin Kilbane.
Of course.
Really, you know, they were really warm and really lovely, which helped. And it was just easy. It just felt easy. But it felt easy because I had sort of rehearsed what my opinion was on the topics of the day. It wasn't sort of off the cuff. And I knew that if I did all right, then it would be like, it would open the door for so many other women. It's like, oh, women can do it. I kind of put that pressure on myself, which maybe isn't healthy, but I think that's the reality. If you're the first one to do it, you've got a target on your back.
It's a classic syndrome, and if you represent, because you're the one person in there, you're representing all of the other all people the who other are a bit like you. And did you expect, I mean, you know, Jim mentioned earlier that kind of toxic Twitter mob style life.
Actually, Twitter at the time was really nice to me. Like, I don't remember seeing anything negative at the time. It was fine. It was really, it gave me a lot of confidence to do more at the time. And I think shortly after I did, I was the first player to do the ITV highlights for the men's European Championships. So it gave me a lot of confidence, because I felt like, you know, I was kind of accepted in the world of punditry at the time. It's slightly different now. It's ironically sort of 12 years on from that. I actually feel now, even as an experienced pundit, that people are just waiting for me to make a mistake. So, for example, I did a Man U game not long ago, and it was a bit of a tongue twister. I was talking about Marcus Rashford and Mason Greenwood in the same sentence. And I ended up saying Mason Greenford, because Rashford Green... Yeah. Anyway, I'd said the right name for the first 45 minutes of the show. I know it's Mason Greenwood, and ended up saying Mason Greenford, and it was like, oh my God, she doesn't know.
She's never heard of this guy.
Get her off the telly. And it's like, come on. So it's just that kind of, that's the pressure, because it's like, we're imperfect, you know, and you've got to be able, even as sort of in terms of delivery. I mean, you guys will know, you do this for a living. Like, you want to just flow, yeah, right? And, you know, maybe if you want to correct yourself, you do. But if you go in there thinking, I have to be absolutely pitch perfect, say the right thing, it's debilitating.
Yeah. You sound like a robot as well.
Right. And I think that's the double standard for women, because a bloke can go on and maybe make that mistake. And it's not even because we're conditioned to see him.
Mm.
But we're not conditioned yet still to see, well, a lot of people aren't necessarily conditioned to hear a woman's voice, let alone see a woman. So it's like, mistake, out.
Yeah. And it's hard. Mistake, out, and that goes for all women as well. That's the thing.
Precisely.
That, yeah.
Precisely. And it's this kind of, oh my God, what is Sky doing? Or what a, you know, this movement towards more women is a joke. And it's just really nasty. But you got to kind of push through that. And I think that's why, you know, people like Alex Scott, it's just amazing, because your skin gets thicker.
Mm.
And you've got to be able to tell yourself, the people that matter think I'm good. It's all festering underneath that app. And I think Twitter now need to really do something about it. But we also have a choice of whether to be on it or not.
Quite.
That is true, but people say you shouldn't leave the playground just because the bullies are in there, don't they? And I mean, in your case, to bring it back to where we started, you know, you can put all of your thoughts in a nice book that people can buy
and
take home and read, which we very much recommend.
Yeah, heartily, absolutely.
Thank you
very
so much. Recommend
reading.
That everyone should read. It's Aniola Aluko, They Don't Teach This. Pick up a coffee now at all good bookshops and make sure to subscribe to Football Ramble Presents wherever you get your podcasts. On the Continent Lives Here, and the next edition of Book Club will head straight to you when it's out in a couple of weeks' time. Thanks for listening to the Book Club with the three of us. We'll catch you next time.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously,
man. Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.